From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, COVID cases surging, a dramatic increase in COVID cases in Sullivan County this week, and the new Omicron variant appears in New York State. We talk live with Sullivan County Health's Nancy McGraw about the urgent alert public health has for everyone. It's beginning to look a lot like snowplows. Winter doesn't officially begin until December 21st, but local road crews are ready and willing to de-ice and plow. Lake Johansson gets a behind-the-scenes look about preparing for local winter road conditions. It's an excerpt from his WJFF podcast, Close to Home. And Gitz Crazy Boy. Gitz is a Canadian Indigenous author, actor, activist, and youth educator. Josh Fox talks to him later today at 1. We'll have a preview. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The parents of the 15-year-old accused of killing four students in this week's shooting at a high school in Michigan are pleading not guilty to involuntary manslaughter charges. They're being arraigned this morning after their arrest overnight in Detroit. President Biden is pledging to make it difficult for Russia's Vladimir Putin to take military action in Ukraine.
We're aware of Russia's actions for a long time, and my expectation is we're going to have a long discussion.
The president speaking to reporters at the White House as he was leaving for a weekend at Camp David. Details of a phone conversation between Biden and Putin for next week are still being worked out. But Biden says he will not accept Moscow's red lines when it comes to Ukraine. Russia does not want Kiev to join NATO. Tens of thousands of Russian troops have been deployed near Ukraine's borders. Nearly a dozen states have now identified cases of the newest coronavirus variant. Much remains unknown about Omicron, but preliminary data show it's more transmissible than Delta, the dominant variant in the U.S., and that reinfections are more likely. South African scientists first identified Omicron and are seeing a surge in cases, especially among children, as Ishma Fundikwa reports from Harare.
Officials say there is no evidence suggesting Omicron poses a greater danger to younger children than previous variants, as all ages in South Africa are seeing a steep increase in infections and hospitalization. Deputy Health Minister Dr. Sibongiseni Dhlomo confirmed the rise in child admissions to a local television station.
We are actually noticing that some of the children are being admitted, but a lot are not going even to the ICU. They go into the general ward 2 or 3 days, then they get discharged.
He added that because the positivity rate has risen to more than 25%, up from 1% 2 weeks ago, South Africa is now in the fourth wave of the pandemic. For NPR News, I am Ish Mafundikwa in Harare.
Several European countries are considering how to resume a diplomatic presence in Afghanistan without recognizing the Taliban as a legitimate government. Terry Schultz reports that French President Emmanuel Macron announced the effort today while on a visit to the Middle East.
The European Union has long said it believes at least a minimal diplomatic presence in Kabul is necessary, but that it will not grant political legitimacy to the Taliban. Now President Macron says countries may soon open up a joint diplomatic mission in Afghanistan, possibly in a common location, that would allow their ambassadors to return to the country. He says the security situation remains to be worked out. Many of Afghanistan's Taliban rulers are under U.S. and U.N. sanctions. Most countries refuse to release financial assistance to the militants as long as they maintain repressive policies against women and minorities and reject political and ethnic diversity in the government. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
And you're listening to NPR News. The Chinese government has issued a defense of its political system, saying it has established a thriving democracy. The BBC's Michael Bristow reports.
Beijing has published a document entitled China, Democracy That Works, which claims Chinese people enjoy freedom of speech, demonstration, and religion. It says China has what it calls a whole process democracy in which everyone in society can get involved. That description jars with reality. China is a one-party state where there are no elections for national leaders and people's rights are severely curtailed. No opposition to the Communist Party is allowed. The document appears to be a response to President Biden's decision to host a summit for democracy next week. to which China hasn't been invited.
The BBC's Michael Bristow reporting. Polls are open today in the West African nation of Gambia, where voters are deciding a tight presidential election. Incumbent President Adama Barrow is facing five challengers. Results are expected by tomorrow. The election is the first that will not have former dictator Yahya Jammeh on the ballot. He was ousted in 2016 and fled the country after refusing to accept the outcome. Indonesia's Semeru volcano has been sending thick columns of smoke and ash into the sky today. The volcano in East Java province erupted suddenly, causing panic in several villages that were blanketed. At least one person is reported dead and dozens injured. Weather forecasters say a storm system may result in flooding this weekend in Hawaii and even blizzard conditions on the high summits of the Big Island. The National Weather Service says the summits could see a foot of snow or more. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include DuckDuckGo, committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer internet privacy with one download. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified at DuckDuckGo.com.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Earlier this week on Twitter, Governor Kathy Hochul announced that the Omicron variant of the COVID-19 virus has appeared in New York State. Yesterday, she tweeted, "We're all in this together. We'll continue to work closely with public health experts and cities and counties across the state to keep New Yorkers safe. Quote, get vaccinated, get your booster, and get tested." Last night, Sullivan County Public Health Director Nancy McGraw issued a masking and vaccination alert with COVID-19 cases spiking dramatically in the area. And Public Health Director Nancy McGraw joins us live now. Nancy, thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Last night, you issued a statement about what's going on in Sullivan County. If you could just set the scene with what is going on. It says in this press release that there's a dramatic spike. What does that mean for listeners?
Yes, well, the week prior to Thanksgiving and especially after Thanksgiving, we saw a huge spike in cases, and we're not alone. That's happening across the state as well. With the move to indoor activities and schools being indoors this winter and heading into the holidays, we did anticipate that, but we were a little surprised by the rate at which the positive cases took off because of our vaccination efforts.
So it was something that you expected just because of the general arc of, like, you know, moving indoors and winter. What is causing this spike, do you think?
Well, we still have a good number of people who are not vaccinated, especially in our younger population. So, you know, a lot of the new cases in the last 3 months have been among schools, either adults or children who are not vaccinated as they move indoors, despite the mask wearing, which may not always be really consistent as much as we would like it to be. But it is community widespread everywhere.
Right. And can you give us the latest numbers?
Sure. As of yesterday, we had 476 active cases and 1,110 people in isolation or quarantine, which is the most we've had since the beginning of the pandemic, when it was at its highest peak.
I think that's important for folks to hear. This is the most that we've had since the peak last April.
Right.
Wow. And you said 11 people in the hospital, 3 people remain in intensive care. What do you think will happen in terms of hospitalizations if we keep seeing this going? Will it strain our system?
Well, we're in a good situation now with our hospital in terms of bed capacity, and we do have very good vaccination rates in our older population, 65 and older. It's 81%, 87%, and 84%. Of the age groups of 55 and older, 65 and older, and 75 and older. Early in the pandemic, those were the age groups we saw the most hospitalizations and deaths. So they have much better protection. What we're concerned about is the younger age groups and people in their 30s and 40s and even 50s and 60s who are not vaccinated, who have underlying health conditions that put them at higher risk of hospitalization. That is the that's the group really that are ending up needing hospital care. So, you know, the message is please get vaccinated if you have been putting it off so far.
It's an article in today's New York Times about upstate hospitals being overwhelmed by COVID surges in the area, mainly focusing in the North Country, Western New York. How is it in our area? Do you have information about hospitalization numbers here? Are they overwhelmed or are we doing okay?
Well, there's 11 people in our hospital as of yesterday who are COVID positive and went to the hospital as a result of not feeling well. I think the highest that we've had in our local hospital, Garnet Health in Harris, it has been about 28 or almost 30 at the height of the pandemic last year. That was a lot. So they do have capacity to handle a lot more, but we would prefer not to see that, obviously. The good news, too, is that there's not as many people ending up on ventilators. The treatments that they have available, and I think, you know, are much more effective. We know more than we knew a year ago in terms of how to treat people. But certainly to prevent it in the first place is what we want to do by using, you know, masking, social distancing, hand washing, and vaccination really is the best protection because people who are fully vaccinated in New York have a 90 to 95% lower chance of being hospitalized as a result of if they do get COVID-19. And I want to just stress that, you know, I see a lot of comments out on social media that, you know, why get the vaccine if you're going to get COVID anyway? Well, you may. I mean, no vaccine is 100% effective, and nobody has ever said that it was. What it does is provide you with very, very good protection so that if you are exposed and you do get infected, similar to the flu, your chances of getting really, really sick are very small if you're fully vaccinated.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Public Health Director of Sullivan County, Nancy McGraw, about the spike in cases in Sullivan County. Nancy, earlier you mentioned the number of cases that you're seeing is predominantly, or unvaccinated, I mean, coming from younger folks. Yesterday, or actually on Thursday, the superintendent of schools for Eldred Central School District sent a note to parents and guardians saying that yesterday they would go virtual for learning and returning to in-person instruction on Monday, the 13th. Mainly because of a sharp increase in the number of positive COVID cases and some of the severity following the Thanksgiving holiday. Are you seeing that trend as well in other parts of the county?
You know, the decision that schools make to go remote or to temporarily close is really based on that school district's unique circumstances. You know, it's based on the number of positive cases, the number of staff that are out who are available to, you know, be available for teaching. And the districts have those responsibility to make those decisions. Often they will consult with our departments and they'll kind of ask us what's going on in the rest of the county. Our goal, however, is try to keep schools open. We know that it's very difficult for a lot of the families across the county who may not have good internet service or internet service at all to have their children have to have remote learning. Of course, it's disruptive to working parents. So the goal is to keep schools open and in class, but we also have to balance that with safety. And we are seeing a lot of cases related to school exposures. So we're keeping a very close eye on this, and you know, districts will make those decisions based on what's best for their school district communities.
And of course, dominating the headlines this week nationally, this is the Omicron variant. Kind of hit closer to home when Governor Hochul announced via Twitter this week, I believe on Wednesday, that it was found in New York City, a case on Long Island. That hits a little close to home. It's not too far away. What do you know about the Omicron variant in our area, or what you're learning from state officials as well?
Well, we're just, I think, taking the approach of, you know, be vigilant and wary and watch for it. It is being tested for by our state laboratories. But, you know, it's just a matter of time. The Delta variant continues to be our biggest threat that's making people sick right now. We're keeping an eye on this Omicron variant because we don't know how it's going to behave in our particular population. It's been detected in New Jersey, Canada, Nebraska, I believe, California. So it's just a matter of time. What's happening with the Omicron variant in South Africa so far, and, you know, they're saying that it will be a few weeks before they really have enough data and research to kind of tell us exactly how it's acting and how it's affecting people and what types of people who are highest risk. That'll be the same here, you know, if it does pop up in our county and New York State, obviously, it's here. In the city, we expected it to show up in New York City first because of the population density and the international travelers. It's just a matter of time. So it does seem to be highly transmissible, highly contagious, but it doesn't seem to be making people as sick. But that's just a matter of time. That could change for our population. You know, viruses continue to mutate. This is why we want to continue to promote vaccination, because, you know, the more protection that people have, and we don't know how this variant is going to hold up against our current vaccine. Our current vaccine for COVID-19 vaccines, the three vaccines that we have, are showing really pretty good efficacy against the Delta variant. We don't know, you know, it's going to be a time... just going to have a matter of time to watch and see how it holds up against other variants like Omicron.
And it is highly transmissible, but the cases or the symptoms are fairly mild. Is that right?
In the cases that the World Health Organization has been tracking in South Africa, that's the information that we currently have right now.
And we know that cases have ticked up in surrounding counties, Wayne County, Orange, and Ulster County, causing Ulster County Executive to issue a state of emergency for that county. But Sullivan County's actually been under a state of emergency since August, right? Unlike other New York counties that let that go away. What does that mean, and why is that important?
Right. We never lifted our state of emergency. Our county manager has renewed it. And that's because even though the cases dropped, they never really dropped to a really low number. What it means is that we can just quickly access resources if needed, if the cases suddenly spike or we need additional support through emergency management and the state health department for either our hospital, our healthcare providers, or our public health department. You know, whether that's in the form of supplies, for vaccine testing, masks, and whatnot.
And you're urging folks, of course, to get vaccinated. Let's remind folks where they can get vaccinated. What you have a website, and there are other pediatric clinics and clinics coming up. Can you talk to us about those to remind folks?
Yes. I think the easiest thing for folks to find out of the list of all of our clinics is to go on our county website, which is www.sullivanny.us. And once they're on our website, they'll see sort of at the top there's a yellow banner and there's a red button that says click here or register here for vaccines. And it'll take you right to our department's public health page. And we update that that page with vaccination clinics sometimes two or three times a week, depending on what's happening. We have pediatric clinics scheduled. And these are open if, say, for example, we have it at a school district. It's open to any child in the county who's eligible. So if we have a pediatric clinic for 5 to 11-year-olds, let's say at Monticello School District coming up on December 20th. You don't have to be a Monticello School District student. You can be from anywhere in the county and attend that. But we do encourage people to register. We want to make sure we have enough vaccine for those clinics. Also, there's a list of all the pharmacies in the county that have vaccine, both for adults and for children. And we would encourage people to call ahead to register because they are quite busy. But and check with your healthcare provider because there are healthcare providers offering pediatric vaccine as well as adult vaccine.
The website is sullivanny.us, and also the public health has a phone call, a phone number 845-513-2268. Also, you're encouraging masking and social distancing. I think it's a good time to remind people what that actually means. It's, you know, we've gone through this period where a lot of folks have laxed those guidelines and following those processes and procedures. Could you remind folks again what that, those the basic rules we all kind of learned last year or the year before?
Yeah, exactly. And it's we've been repeating it for 2 years now, but it's like something that you have to just keep repeating because it is, you know, those are the most effective tools that we have. But I do want to correct that phone number. They should call us at 845-292-5910 during Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, because the other number you gave is for a separate line.
Okay, sorry, that was from that press release. So it's
292-5910.
5910, we'll make sure we get that corrected. And again, those rules that folks should be following in terms of social distancing and masking.
Yes.
6 feet apart when you can't.
6 feet apart. If you're indoors, especially wear masks. But if you're outdoors in a very crowded situation at an event, you should be wearing a mask. If you're, you know, closer than 6 feet for a period of 15 minutes or more, wash your hands. Get vaccinated and wear a mask even if you're vaccinated indoors because of the widespread, you know, the number of cases that are going up. People who are vaccinated are also testing positive, obviously not getting as sick or very sick at all, but still you can transmit it to others. So they're recommending boosters for anybody 18 and older at this point as eligible. So if it's been 6 months or more since you've gotten fully vaccinated, you are eligible for a booster for Pfizer and Moderna. And I believe it's 2 months or longer for the J&J shot. If you got the first one and you want a second one, that's available too.
And any thoughts on the holidays, holiday travel, parties? I know I was just invited to something next week, which is an indoor gathering with a lot of people, and I'm kind of rethinking it. What advice do you have for folks for the holidays in terms of gathering and travel?
I think we need to just continue to use the common sense prevention measures and stick to them, and we can have our get together safely. The problem is you don't know the vaccination status of other people at your social event unless it's a requirement of that event sponsor. So if you're, you know, regardless, you should, a vaccination status, you should wear a mask indoors. If you're at a party, try to keep your distance from others and wash your hands. I don't think that, you know, canceling everything is necessarily going to make a difference at this point if people are fully vaccinated. And that is the best tool we have to keep things open and be able to enjoy the holidays and our families and travel. You know, we saw the huge negative economic and social impact on closures last year. I don't see that happening, and it may not be necessary, but we do need to continue to encourage people who are on the fence or have not yet decided to get a vaccine. Go ahead and get vaccinated because that's going to provide our community with that much more protection.
And before we go, I wanted to ask, how are you doing? You know, almost 2 years into this and you're on the front line of all of this. How are you holding up?
Well, you know, we have a great team, and we, you know, we're exhausted. I'm exhausted, but we have to take time to take care of ourselves. This has really been a life changer and a career changer for a lot of the people that work for me, certainly, and for most of the people that work in public health. I think it has certainly underscored our dedication and our, you know, to public health and to why we do what we do in terms of protecting people, educating them about how to stay safe, what do you need to do to keep your family safe, and, you know, what don't we know and what do we know. So, yeah, it's been very challenging. I know a lot of people at the state level and nationally have moved on to other jobs because they're so exhausted. But we are really dedicated and, you know, certainly believe in what we're doing. So thanks for asking the question.
Well, we appreciate everything that you and public health are doing. And do you see light at the end of this tunnel?
I do. You know, last winter we said, well, hopefully it will be over in the spring. And we never expected yet another variant or for the cases to shoot through the roof. But we kind of did this winter because we need to remember that even as recently as in the spring of this year, a lot of the school districts were only at 50% in-person learning. So we've pretty much brought back 100% of kids to school indoors. And that's the group and population that has the lowest vaccination rate. It wasn't available until May, June of this year to 12 to 17-year-olds and very recently for 5 to 11-year-olds. So we're still in another race to get this particular group of our population vaccinated and protected.
We've been talking with Sullivan County Public Health Director Nancy McGraw. She and public health are urgently encouraging residents to stay masked in close public quarters and to get themselves and their families fully vaccinated as we see a dramatic increase in COVID cases in the county and in our area. For questions about the coronavirus, you can go to the county's website, sullivanny.us. The New York State website is health.ny.gov. In Pennsylvania, that's health.pa.gov. And there's also cdc.gov for more information. Nancy McGraw, thank you so much for joining us. Get some rest.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me, and stay safe.
When we come back, Winter Road Upkeep. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
If you hear good music, you're listening to Radio Catskill. Your weekend can't even begin until Clyde Alvin Yates III sets it off Saturday night at 7. At 9, an hour of global sounds from the African diaspora on Afropop. Then at 10, Selector Starkey and DJ Chuck spend 4 hours of funk, hip-hop, roots reggae, club classics, and more live on Old School Sessions. Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
This group is dangerous.
I chose an autumn theme today. There are so many great tunes from the American Songbook that have been written about the season.
Join us as we close out the fall season on Sunday Stage with Autumn Serenade, a great jazz piano performance by Bill Mays, recorded live in Homesdale. That's Sunday evening at 7, only on Radio Catskill's Sunday Stage.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. You know those big yellow snowplows you get stuck behind? Well, they're out there doing a big job for all of us. There are 18 county plows in Sullivan County, and they're keeping hundreds of miles of roads passable through the long Catskill winters. WJFF's Leif Johansson spoke to Sullivan County Public Works Commissioner Ed McAndrew about winter road upkeep in the area in an episode from his podcast, Close to Home. It's at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, This year is flying by. I can hardly believe it, but temperatures are already dropping. The car has frost on it in the mornings now, and the holidays are right around the corner. And all that has gotten me thinking about snow. Lots and lots of snow. And how, despite all the snow we get in the Catskills every winter, our transportation infrastructure stays intact. And it's so easy to take that for granted, but we have over 1,000 miles of roads in Sullivan County alone. We have about 400 bridges. We have major highways, one-lane dirt roads, narrow mountain corridors, and everything in between. And for the most part, they are all passable all winter long. When I was growing up, my dad was, and still is, a high school teacher. And I used to ride into school with him at 6:30 every morning. And even if we had gotten 8 inches of snow the night before, our road was almost always completely clear by the time we were pulling out of the driveway, well before the sun came up. And honestly, that's kind of mind-blowing. So I wanted to know how that works, how winter road maintenance teams can plow, salt, or sand our roads so efficiently and on such short notice. Because even though we have relatively accurate weather forecasting technology, the fluctuation of just a few degrees in temperature can completely change the landscape of what our roads need in order to be safe to travel on. So, with the coming winter season in mind, I got on the phone with Ed McAndrew, the Commissioner of Public Works for Sullivan County.
For us, winter maintenance, snow and ice control is almost a year-round thing we do. By the time we get our trucks ready in the fall to go through the winter and change our trucks back over in the spring, there isn't much time in between there where we're not somehow involved in snow and ice control. And that's just the way that goes. We have 385 miles of county roads, of which we contract with the towns to do some of our roads. The state does a little bit. Plus, we also do part of Route 97 for the state. So there's an interaction in how we get everything done. We don't generally use sand anymore. We've gone to just pure salt in almost all cases now with our roads. As long as you control it well, which is what we do, we put down a certain poundage, maybe 200 pounds per lane mile as we're plowing. We have ground speed controls on our trucks, so whether you speed up or slow down, it keeps the same amount of salt coming out. And we're very busy with that right now. We'll spend upwards of $1 million a year on salt in order to maintain the roads. We run...
Holy cow.
Yeah, yeah. It's $60 to $70 a ton delivered. And keeping enough salt on hand is always a challenge. We have four locations that we plow out of. And keeping those all those stations stocked with salt is a very busy part of the winter for a couple of our people to make sure that supply doesn't fall out. If needed, we help the towns. They'll help each other out, you know, in case somebody is short on something. We always step in and do that. In the past few years, we started to do pre-treatment of our roads with a brine solution, a salt brine solution, where we'll go out with trucks and actually spray that on the roads before a storm hits. It slows down the snow from collecting on the roads in the beginning of the storm. During a storm, you still have to plow, but it cleans up very nicely after a storm. After the snow stops, it's much easier to clear the roads that have been pre-treated. So we've taken that up, and we have multiple trucks that we do that with now. And we get that actually to brine from New York State DOT. We have a deal worked with them, and they have a processing. They actually make it. We buy it from them.
So why the switch from sand to salt? I mean, obviously, salt is going to actually melt ice or keep ice from forming. Sand isn't going to do that. It just provides traction. But why the switch only recently?
It's not just recently. It's been years that we've been doing this. We started with a 50-50 mix of sand salt, and some people are still doing that. As long as you control the amount of salt you're putting out, it actually is cheaper, and the cleanup is much easier in the spring. You don't have all the sand on the road because the sand doesn't go away. So in the springtime, you have to clean that up and pick it up in a lot of locations. It plugs up culverts. It plugs up catch basins. So the more you can get away from just putting sand on the road, the better. And in a lot of cases, the effectiveness of sand does wear off as it gets coated with snow. Once it becomes snowballs and brown snow, it's still not the same kind of traction. And like you said, the salt actually takes the snow off the roads.
So
there are concerns to the environment, but there are concerns no matter what we do with that.
Yeah, and I'm curious about what those environmental concerns related to salting the roads are.
Oh, it's always been salination into the water supplies, lakes, rivers. There is not a good alternative at this point. Sand also is a concern getting into everything, into the water courses and all. So whatever we're putting down is always going to have some effect, unless we go back to people having to drive on snow-covered roads.
So you mentioned that we have something to the tune of 385 miles of roadways in Sullivan County, which is just mind-blowing. It's so much road that needs to be cleared. And so how do roads get prioritized when it snows? I mean, obviously, we have a finite number of plow trucks and folks to drive those trucks and whatnot. So who's making those decisions and how are those decisions made?
The county itself, we plow about 212 miles of our county road plus 27 of the state. So we're plowing somewhere around in the neighborhood of 250 miles, say, that we plow. We actually hit them all the same. We have four stations that we plow out of. We have one in town of Thompson, essentially in Mongop Valley, or Maplewood, that's our main facility. But we also have them in Berryville, Calicoon, and Livingston Manor. We do four routes out of each one of the outlying stations and usually six out of Maplewood. Each plow route will be about 2 hours long. It takes the guys to do one route, but they're hitting all the roads. Primarily, a lot more of our plowing occurs in the northern half of the county. As you know, Rockland, Calicoon, Liberty get much more snow than Forestburg, Thompson, and Mamakating do. So we'll be coming out to those more often. Usually we'll plow till around midnight if a storm is going on and starts during the day. We'll keep trucks out till around midnight. Then we usually bring them in, depending on the severity of the storm, and put them back out again around 4 or 5 in the morning ahead of school buses and commuters. So you do generally, if the storm allows for it, take a break during the middle of the night, just switch over the guys. But we'll have two crews essentially that can rotate through a truck. So this guy's on call this week, and then they'll switch over at a certain number of hours. We'll switch the guys in the trucks. So each route or each truck will have two different drivers depending on the length of the storm.
So if you're doing about 250 miles of roadway and there's 380 miles of county roadway in the county, who's taking care of the other 130 miles, give or take, of roads?
We contract with the towns. We actually pay them with different towns. Some do all the roads. Mamakating and Fallsburg do all the county roads in those towns. And St. Liberty and Rockland, Neversink do some of them. It depends, you know, on the town. Some don't do any. Some do, like I said, a varying degree of it. And we also work with New York State DOT, where they do a little bit of our roadway and we do some of their roadway. We have contracts for all of that, and we go back and forth with them. Some of the towns, you know, if they have enough staff, they will go ahead and do our roads since they're driving over them anyway.
Plow trucks obviously are used a lot throughout the winter, and I imagine they take quite the beating all winter long. Do you have a broad estimate of how much these county plow trucks are costing, how long they'll last, what kind of repairs are needed on a regular basis just to keep them functional, because we all depend on them to be functional so we can do anything all winter long.
Mm-hmm. The trucks can vary. We have, say, a dozen mechanics in the county that we keep trucks running. We keep one spare truck in each facility is our goal during the winter. So if you got four routes, and the trucks do break down, there's no question about it. And this year, we're concerned with the availability of goods and services throughout the country and trying to get parts for some of these trucks. So we actually do have some concerns going into this winter. Right now, we're in good shape. We try to buy one or two trucks a year and replace them out, because we do run quite a few trucks. Like I said, 12, 18 to 20 routes that are going on right now, 18 anyway. So you got to have at least 18 tandems plus another four in reserve, plus you have smaller trucks that you're running. So it is an expensive proposition. These trucks are probably in the order of $200,000 of fully, you know, when you get into these outfitted trucks or more. So you're spending a lot on them, and you are spending a lot in the repairs. And it varies from truck to truck and how many miles they have on them and the age. So, but we try to rotate them out and sell them when there's still some value to them and buy new ones.
And the folks that are driving the trucks, are they contracted employees to only work during the winter for the county, or do they work for you all year long and they're doing something else
all year round? Yeah, these are all, we don't have any contracted employees in that manner. Ours are our road maintenance crews that will be out working on the roads all summer long. Actually, some of the plowmen might be, some of the mechanics will plow at times. The bridge crews may plow also. So it's a variant. It's the bulk of it comes out of our road maintenance department, but we will use other people within the department also plow.
And then outside of just plowing alone, what else needs to happen to maintain the functionality of our transportation infrastructure in our region during the winter?
Plowing is the big part of it. And I mean, you think of plowing during the storm, but then we also do cleanup afterwards. We not only do the roads, we also do the government center parking lot, the jail parking lot, all the facilities in Liberty's parking lot. We actually plow the college parking lot as well and pick up all that snow. And then depending on the amount of snow, you push it back so far, but we actually will truck snow out of, especially the parking lots, you know, when the storms are over and there's a big pile of snow there. If it melts, great, but a lot of times it doesn't here. So we'll end up actually taking loaders, loading tandem trucks and hauling snow to dump sites to get it out of the way. Same thing with roads. You have to push the snow back on the roads, and that works to a point, and then you actually have to clean up.
You know, there's obviously the cold months are tough on our roadways. You know, a lot of cracks and potholes forming all over the place throughout the winter. And so can you give us an understanding of why roads get so badly beaten up during the winter, and what kind of repairs need to be done in order to fix that? And are they done during the winter for the most part, or do those actual road repairs need to wait until the spring?
The biggest problem with roads in the winter is a freeze-thaw cycle where there's water underneath the road that forms into an ice lens and pushes the road up when it's frozen, and then it melts and the road comes back down. So it's a freeze-thaw kind of thing, pushing the road as the water freezes, expands, and contracts. That's what damages the roads the most. It's not so much the traffic going over them. It's more water is almost always the cause one way or another in it. And the water that gets stuck under the roads, and the roads are bared up, so they can actually, frost can go deeper under them, but then again, they're black and the sun can melt those top layers of ice, and it just starts, and the salt is on them. So it's causing a lot of movement in our roads. We can do some patching in the winter. We have what's called winter mix, which is a cold asphalt product It's certainly not as good, but we will fix roads temporarily through the winter. It's primarily you have to get it in the construction season in the summer around here to really do road repair. In the winter, it never holds as well.
Is the need to wait until summer because asphalt factories are, you know, essentially frozen all winter?
Essentially, yeah. You can't run and keep asphalt warm enough to pave.
Got it.
You might be able to, but it would be at a great expense. I mean, it would be a huge cost to try and do that. And in the summer, it's already costing us. When we pave a road, if we just go in and pave a road and you put 3 inches of asphalt on top of it, that's $250,000 per mile. So,
whoa,
$1 million gets you 4 miles of paving, and we have 385 to do. So it's a challenging thing to keep the budgets in hand here.
Do the winter months cause a lot of damage to bridges as well that need repairs and assessment?
That's an ongoing thing too. Yeah. Our climate, as you know, is certainly challenging. Depends on the winter, and the northern half of the county probably sees, we figure, an extra 2 to 3 weeks of winter, say Rockland has over mammocating. So it varies throughout the entire area. You know, obviously the higher elevations in Rockland and Neversink and Liberty see a lot more weather than the lower ones. The bridges are an ongoing problem. If you allow water into them and it freezes and thaws, just like the roads, it's going to cause damages to the bridges. So we always try to keep the tops of those sealed off as best as we can. We actually just finished our bridge inspection program in-house. We inspect our bridges every year. The state does an inspection program on them as well so that we can keep an eye on them. And
all 400 bridges?
Everything over 20 feet, which is hundreds of them, but that's everything over 5 feet. We own all the... Anything over 20 feet on a town road, the county has taken over. So we maintain all the bridges on the town roads as well. That's how we end up with that high a number. And it's a combination between the state inspections and the county inspection. But yes, at least every other year, we want every structure inspected.
Well, Ed, thanks so much for your time. Last question for you. Do you have any winter road safety advice for all of us? I mean, what do people often get wrong that you hear about staying safe on roads in the winter? And any advice on navigating roads that are icy and snowy effectively?
It's always been speed is the biggest issue. There's no question about it. It's, you can go fast on snow. You can't stop on snow, though, as quickly. That's where a lot of the problems come in. People going, yeah, I can stay in control until something causes them to need to stop. And that does not happen the same on a dry pavement. So that's always been our biggest concern. Have patience. Our guys are doing, and not just our guys, the state guys, the town guys, the village guys, spend a lot of time and effort at this. They spend a lot of long hours out there. You know, and in the middle of the night when you're plowing at 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning and ongoing throughout the winter, give them some credit and, you know, for what they're doing out there, because it is not an easy job.
I think this is an opportune moment to double down on Ed's reminder to drive safely and slowly this winter in our region. And get a good pair of snow tires, too. It makes a big difference on those roads. Your all seasons are no match for winter in upstate New York. And at the end of the day, no matter how high the clearance on your vehicle is or how studded your tires are, the moment you hit a patch of ice, you are more than likely, for all intents and purposes, royally screwed. So stay home when you can, make some hot cocoa, and have a toast to the folks that are going out there to plow our roads. Big thanks to Sullivan County Public Works Commissioner Ed McAndrew for taking the time to chat in today's episode. And as always, Thank you for listening. I'm Leif Johansson, and this is Close to Home, a production of WJFF Radio Catskill. Also, if you like what you hear on here, or if you have some other programs from WJFF that you enjoy, don't hesitate to head on over to WJFFradio.org and pitch in a few bucks. We are proudly listener-supported radio, and if you're hearing this right now, that means you. Thank you so much for your support, and have a great week.
Leif Johansson, an excerpt from his Close to Home podcast at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, a preview of the Staying Home with Josh Fox episode later today at 1. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Scott Simon. If you've raised children, you know the best way to address fear is with truthful information, calmly and comfortingly delivered. That's what NPR News always tries to do in times of crisis, too. That old car in your driveway can actually help us. By donating it to this station, you'll turn your car into more solid information brought to you by voices you trust. Here's how.
Donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Josh Fox is an American film director, playwright, and environmental activist. He may be best known for his Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning 2010 documentary Gasland, but he's also known for his Radio Catskill program, Staying Home with Josh Fox. That's later today at 1 o'clock. Today, he's speaking with Gits Crazy Boy, a Canadian Indigenous author, actor, activist, and youth educator, whose debut novel, Secrets of the Stars, made Amazon's top 10 bestsellers in Native American literature. Josh spoke to the activist and environmental activist for environmental and Indigenous rights, and here's a preview.
Let's talk a little bit about the ongoing political struggles that are happening right now. There are a lot of incredible, horrifying images coming out of Canada right now in Wet'suwet'en territory and other places where I think Americans think of the Canadians as much more polite. The Canadians are much more mild. Oh, we don't, the Canadians don't have guns. Oh, they have nationalized healthcare. But when it comes to brutality against First Nations people, some of the most brutalizing things I've ever seen are coming out of Canada. The RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, going in, abusing Indigenous women, going in and doing all of the same things that we saw with incredible brutality, like at Ferguson in America or at Standing Rock. Talk about the struggles that are happening right now, you know, because you have, we became friends as frontline activists, you fighting the tar sands. Talk a little bit about how those struggles are going, whatever you can report on for us down here, your neighbors to the south.
Indigenous peoples have been policed intensely since Stephen Harper took power. I don't know if that was like 10, 15 years ago, yeah. But he upped it on the monitoring of Indigenous folks. So they know who we are. Like if you gathered, we were doing the like Idle No More gatherings, which were these peaceful round dances to try to awaken people about the injustices we were going through.
Idle No More being this incredible slogan, but also a kind of an organization. Yeah.
Ish. I mean, it was just a slogan that people got behind, rallied behind. There was no real central leader, although mm-hmm. people did get money. Like Idle No More was a person who's like, okay, there's some injustices. Let's all get together. We'll do a round dance. We'll be good neighbors. But we were policed, heavily policed. We're over-policed. We're monitored. So they know who we are. They know our movements. They know the people in the movements. The RCMP themselves, which is our Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they were created to police Indigenous peoples, to remove us from the lands that the colonizers had taken and bring us back to the reservations, or to beat us, or to kill us, or to harass us. That's why the RCMP were there. They were there to sedate, and they were there to control forcibly the Indigenous peoples. They're also the ones who came to the reservations to take the kids away from their parents and put them in the residential schools. They were also there to enforce taking the parents who wanted their kids back and throw them in jail. They're also the ones who, if kids ran away, they'd bring those kids right back to those reservations. You know, they're the ones who enforced the forced starvation, the calculated starvation that the prime minister had done to the indigenous peoples. I mean, this is what the RCMP historically have been. They're the ones who are underreporting what's happening to the indigenous women. That's why there's an epidemic of indigenous women going murdered or being missing by not following up in leads, by flat out lying or leaving stuff out of reports. It's now in the consciousness of like Canadians and hopefully some Americans, but this is the truth we've known for like decades and decades and decades because we were going to the police and we were filing these reports. So within the consciousness of the RCMP themselves, they've known about this for decades and have done nothing about it. So them going on to a reservation to kick off the people or to forcibly remove them from the Wet'suwet'en camps, that's nothing new for us. What they talk about being on the side of law and justice, when white people tell us, go back to the res, you dirty Indian, and we're back on the res. Now they're saying, you know, go live sustainably off the land. And you have somebody like Canis Manuel and the Tiny House Warriors who went back to their lands, who are living sustainably off their lands. The Unist'ot'en camp is the same thing.
Right.
They're still there. And they're still trying to remove us from our own territories. Still trying. And a lot of the nations in BC didn't sign a treaty, which means that like for Canada to have existed, they needed to have this agreement between Indigenous peoples and the government for them to expand. And they did these peace treaties because of how much the Indian wars were costing America, financially almost breaking, you know, the Americans, because you came out of the Civil War right into the Indian wars. And they thought they would just run over all these Indigenous peoples, but they found us to be very resilient and very tactful, and it was costing them more money. So Canada signed these peace agreements across Canada so they could expand. That's everything like west of the Red River, because there's a Red River Rebellion, you'll see, because that was all uncharted territory. BC, they never really signed any treaties because I believe at the time they didn't think it'd be viable. Right. So you have all these Indigenous peoples who are living on their territories, never signed a treaty, land is still theirs, who are now being removed forcibly from their lands. All of these nations have given these oil developments alternative routes that don't hit any of their sacred sites, places of like resources for animals, nothing. They left this space open, and these colonizers are just still pushing through, still saying, no, we want this one pipeline to go right through your, you know, where the salmon are going to run, or near this place where, you know, you harvest medicines and berries that your people have done for thousands and thousands and thousands of generations.
Right.
Like, this is what's going to happen. You need to get out of the way.
That is a conversation with Josh Fox and Gits Crazy Boy. You can hear that full interview today on Staying Home with Josh Fox at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill. Right after the Janice Adams Show at noon, Catskill Character at 11:30 with Donna Fellenberg, and Farm and Country, which is coming up next from Rosie Starr and the team. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Arnold House, up on top of Chandelier, featuring 14 guest rooms, a seasonally rotating menu at the tavern, greenhouse gardens, barn, and more. TheArnoldHouse.com. From the Narrowsburg Union, featuring the 2021 Holiday Market, Saturdays and Sundays through December 19th. And Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. NarrowsburgUnion.com. And from listeners like you.
The year is almost over, and the gift you make today will help this NPR station bring you the news you'll need tomorrow. Here's how to give now and keep your future self in the know.
Support us now and beyond by making your year-end gift now at WJFFradio.org. Your support today leads to a greater tomorrow. Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
On this week's On the Media, a consumer's guide to navigating stories about Omicron. For one thing, beware headlines that stress its newness.
It is a new variant, but it's not a completely new virus. It's not a pigeon transforming into a tiger. It's a pigeon that's maybe grown a mustache.
Come for the media analysis, stay for the pigeon analogies on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville. We are Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.